Hi, I'm Tom Hall. It's Friday, and it's Maryland Morning. This morning, we're going to take a look at one of the most pressing and pernicious problems our city faces. An estimated 16,000 vacant houses litter the landscape of Baltimore, stultifying and paralyzing entire communities. Governor Hogan has announced with great fanfare a program to tear down scores of derelict row homes. But after that, what happens next? Researcher Alan Malik talks about solutions and strategies. One of those solutions might be an initiative called Lots Alive, which puts artists to work alleviating blight. We'll talk about that, and Dr. Gina South from the University of Pennsylvania will explain how blight isn't just an issue of cosmetics or crime, it's a serious health issue as well. I'll have an essay about voting in the upcoming primary. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Maryland Morning starts right after the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Baltimore City is embarking on an ambitious $74 million plan to tear down row homes in derelict and vacant blocks and neighborhoods. It's estimated that the city has upwards of 16,000 vacants. Today, we want to get some context for these plans, what policies and practices make eliminating blight successful for city economies and the people who live in those cities, and what locks communities out of economic growth and change. Alan Malik joins me in the studio. He's a city planner, a writer, and senior fellow with the Center for Community Progress. While a senior fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, Mr. Malik wrote a study which looked at best practices for demolition around the country. He was the director of Housing and Economic Development in Trenton, New Jersey for 9 years. He's written several books, and he is working currently with Baltimore City to evaluate the Vacants to Value program. Mr. Malik, thank you for your time. Good morning.
Oh, happy to be here.
So what are some of the demolition strategies that have been employed in other cities, and what have they accomplished, especially when they're done on kind of the large scale that we're talking about here in Baltimore?
Well, I think what's been happening recent years is people in cities like Baltimore, Detroit, Cleveland are realizing that they just have far more houses than they can realistically hope to put back into use in the foreseeable future, and that they just simply can't hold them there, that while they sit there vacant and abandoned, they're really doing harm to the neighborhoods. Demolition has really become a strategy to try to manage the urban environment and eliminate blight. And so cities are really looking at, where should we be demolishing? Where should we be trying to preserve some of these houses and rehabilitate them? How do we reduce the excess supply that we have? And how do we do it in a way that actually makes the neighborhoods better instead of further undermining them?
Because large-scale demolition is not without risk, is it?
It's very problematic. I mean, if you just start knocking down houses without some idea of where you're going from there, you could actually undermine the fabric of a neighborhood. You can obviously are incurring a lot of costs, which have to come from somewheres. You may be involved in relocating or displacing families, so I think Baltimore is trying to minimize that. So demolition is not a painless process.
Of course, it's also costly in a lot of different ways to have a high number of vacants in the city. As you study it, what are the things that we perhaps don't always think about as a cost?
Well, that's the thing that people don't, exactly, they don't appreciate, that every time when you have a vacant and abandoned property sitting there, it's doing huge harm to the city. It's costing the city a lot of money in terms of additional police costs and code enforcement and fire. It's a magnet for crime and for dumping and for fires. It's costing the neighbors a lot. It reduces their property values. If you have a house that's sitting right next to a vacant, abandoned house, that could mean a difference of anything from 10 to 20% or more in the value of your house. It also reduces people's confidence in the neighborhood, their feeling of comfort, whether they can just walk along the street and the sidewalk or not. So these houses are devastating in their impact.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Alan Malik joins me. He's a city planner and scholar. He's studying the Vacants to Values program here in the city of Baltimore. So, Alan, how do you turn an empty lot into an asset?
The first thing you have to do is make sure that it doesn't just become a piece of dirt that people are going to dump on and trash. So the simplest thing, and Philadelphia has really done a beautiful job in this, and I know Baltimore is working in the same directions, is simply to just green it and make sure that after the demolition is finished, somebody comes in, puts grass or sod down, maybe plants a couple of small trees, puts a nice simple fence around it. One of the amazing things we've learned is that if you do just that, which isn't very expensive and very complicated, people will start to see it as something that people care about and are not going to trash it the way they would if it were just dirt let sitting there. So that's a short-term thing. Then you've got to look at, really it goes back to, what is the market and what are the options in this area? You know, cities don't have a lot of money of their own to build houses or shopping centers or anything. So it really depends on, is the market strong enough so that developers are likely to be able to build and come in there either without any public money or with the government simply sort of filling the gap but not actually having to pay for it? Because that's realistically, the government simply doesn't have that much money. So what that means, and it's very difficult, is that some areas in a city could see those lots redeveloped with new housing. Other areas may not. At that point, what you've got to say, if you're not able to redevelop it with housing, how can you turn it into an asset? And this is where people look at what they're calling green solutions. Can you make it into a community garden? Can you make it into a park? Can you make it into ball fields? Can you make it into something that becomes an amenity for the community, either visually, in terms of it looks nice and people feel good being around it, or in terms of something that they can actually use, like a ball field or a garden?
You know, as I read your study, it occurs to me that, you know, as you said, there's this, there's a lot more houses that we have in our city in Baltimore than we need. I mean, Baltimore was at one point a city of 1 million people. Now we're 600,000 people. We simply don't need all those houses. So I would imagine that in most cases, it doesn't make sense to build new houses on these lots because we've already got enough houses.
Well, yes and no. In some cases it does, and in some cases it doesn't. But you got to start with the basic principle that the idea of demolishing houses is not simply about replacing them with more houses. But if you look at some parts of Baltimore are growing. Mm-hmm. You know, a few weeks ago I was over in the Oliver section talking to developers who are rehabbing
there. There's a lot of work going on over there in Oliver,
And they're finding that there are lots of people who want to live in those houses.
And of course, this is the thing, and you talk about this in your report, that demolition is just one single step in the process. I mean, you're studying what's going on here in Baltimore. You've studied what's gone on in cities across the country. Does it appear to you that we have, in fact, a comprehensive plan that includes demolition and then addresses the consequences, both good and bad, that follow that demolition?
I think Baltimore is moving very well in that direction. I'm not quite ready to say they're there, and I don't think they would say they're there either. But I think they're really thinking about these issues, and I think they're approaching these questions very differently than some cities, whom I won't mention, who just see, let's knock it down and hope for the best. Baltimore is looking at greening strategies. They've got a lot of effort going on in the planning department to tie together all the different greening ideas that are going on. I think the people in housing and community development are really trying to be strategic about where do you demolish, where do you rehab, where do you replace. So I think Baltimore is actually doing a better job, I think, than most cities in terms of thinking about what happens next.
Is there a city that, in your mind, serves as a paradigm, as a great example of a successful demolition strategy?
I don't know that there's a paradigm. As I said, I think Baltimore is doing some pretty good things and moving in some pretty good directions. I think Philadelphia is. Detroit is certainly ratcheting up the demolitions. I'm not sure.
They've got even more vacants than we do.
They've got far more vacants than Baltimore has. I mean, Detroit is off the charts in that respect.
The total number of vacant housing units in the United States, according to your report, is over 4.5 million. Okay. I mean, that's up 44% from just a few years ago. So this is a problem that's growing, not abating.
It is a problem that's growing. And it's a problem that You know, we think of it sometimes as it's a problem that you only have in older cities that have lost population, like Detroit or Baltimore. But actually, you see it in neighborhoods in other cities that are still growing. You see it in small towns, rural areas. I've been doing some work in the Chicago area, and you go to the suburbs in South Cook County, south of Chicago, and these are post-war suburbs, and you see vacant boarded-up garden apartments and single-family houses in subdivisions. It's not just a big city problem.
How does a city like our city avoid the pitfall of placing too much emphasis on just demolition?
I think what Baltimore has to do is be very careful about constantly asking the question, what do we do next? What is going to happen to this property after we've demolished these houses? Both what's going to happen to it immediately, so it doesn't become a question of just replacing one type of blight with another, but also, what's our long-term plan? Is this a property that should be a park forever? Should we maybe make it into a park and then look at it again in 5 years? Is this an area where we can build something new? Is there something that the community needs and that we can afford in terms of a community center or a school? So the key thing is to be constantly thinking about what comes after the demolition, so you don't just demolish and then have to fake it.
So talk about some of the other cities who have put together coalitions of different groups to enhance the process of demolition.
Yeah, this is a struggle pretty much everywhere. The basic principle is this really should not just be a matter of people in City Hall looking at maps and saying, this is next, then we go to this. You really should be talking to people in neighborhoods, talking to neighborhood organizations, community development corporations, historic preservation organizations, people who have a stake in the communities and are going to be impacted by whether you demolish or rehab or let the buildings just sit there. I'm not sure that any city does a great job, but I think Cleveland really works very closely with the city and the network of CDCs. They've got a citywide organization called Cleveland Neighborhood Progress that kind of coordinates a lot of the thinking on these issues. Philadelphia, the city has a partner with the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, which really manages a lot of their greening and post-demolition efforts.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house.
Alan Malik is a senior fellow at the Center for Community Progress. We'll have a link to his study about demolition on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up, what are the health effects on children and adults who live in neighborhoods where blight is prevalent? We'll have more on that after a break for news. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to continue our examination of the issue of blight. Earlier in the show, we discussed what policies and approaches have been most successful in eliminating blight in cities like Baltimore. The work that my next guest has done shows why eliminating blight is such an urgent problem. If you live in an area where blight is prevalent, it doesn't just have a negative impact on things like crime and real estate values. It can have a very harmful impact on your health. Dr. Gina South has studied how blight impacts health and well-being in Philadelphia, a city with roughly 40,000 vacants. That's about 24,000 more vacants than we have here in Baltimore. Dr. South is a resident in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She joins me on the phone this morning from WHYY in Philadelphia. Good morning, Doctor. Thank you for your time.
Morning, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So most folks, you know, associate vacant houses with crimes. You know, there's sometimes a lot of drug dealing or prostitution, stuff like that. But you've actually found that vacant houses affect the health of people who are not involved in that kind of activity, but who simply live near and adjacent to properties that are vacant.
Yeah. So, Tom, I got interested in this topic when I was an intern, fresh out of medical school, working in the emergency department. And we had a 11-year-old boy who came into our trauma center who had been shot while he was laying in his house. And as we went through our normal protocol for someone who comes in who's been a victim of a violent crime, he was talking, he had normal vital signs, he was stable. When we asked him to move, he could move his arms, but he could not move his legs. And it turned out that the bullet was actually lodged in his spine, and he was paralyzed from the waist down at 11 years old. I will never forget that patient. It was very profound for me as I began to think about how we treated his medical problems very well, but we did very little to address what was happening in his neighborhood that caused this to happen in the first place. So violent crime and many other health problems are really neighborhood-based phenomena. And what struck me about the neighborhoods in Philadelphia, and I'm sure it's the same in Baltimore, where violent crime and other health problems are rampant, is that they're very blighted. And so I began to think about and study what's the relationship between blight and health, and how can we alter the physical structure of neighborhoods to improve violence, to improve health and safety of communities.
And what specific kinds of health impacts are there? I mean, obviously there's the health impacts of violence, as this, you know, terrible story of this young 11-year-old kid you've just told us about, but what other health impacts are you finding?
So one of the early studies that we did was actually to talk to people in neighborhoods that had high vacancy and abandonment rates, and to find out what people in those neighborhoods, how they felt it impacted their health. And there were several themes that emerged, one of which was the overall well-being of the community, that people felt that increased blight and vacancy reflected poorly on their community and actually affected the relationships between neighbors, which ultimately had an impact on their mental health. Mental health was another big theme that came out, that people experienced stress, anxiety, depression from the blight that was in their neighborhood, how it may have affected them, how it may have affected their children. And then the physical health ramifications of abandoned homes, for example, being dangerous places where fires could start and impacting other homes, where people were going to do illegal activities such as drugs, prostitution, that drew negative attention to their block, to their street, to their neighborhood, and put them at risk for other problems. Prior studies have shown that neighborhoods that have higher rates of vacancy and abandoned homes do have higher rates, like you said, of high blood pressure, diabetes, and even premature mortality. And part of it is hypothesized that the vacancy is causing perhaps a stress in these neighborhoods, a toxic stress that has ramifications for long-term health.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Dr. Gina South. She's in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. You did one study, Dr. South, in which you actually geocoded heart rate readings of people as they walked past randomly selected vacant lots in a neighborhood in Philadelphia. Why were you measuring their heart rate? What did that tell you ultimately?
So as I mentioned, we know that neighborhoods and where people live impact health, but we don't have a great understanding of the biological mechanisms through which this occurs. So how does where someone live, quote unquote, get under their skin to impact health? And one of the things we hypothesize is that it is through something called toxic stress. And so in this study, we used heart rate as a measure for stress. Your stress response is a normal and actually very healthy response that the body has. So for example, if you're in the jungle and you come across a bear, you need to run to get to safety. Your body shuts down all unnecessary function and really focuses your attention, gets your heart rate up so that you can run and get away from that danger. So this is a good response. However, if you are in a situation where that response is activated day in and day out from stressors, perceived or real threats in your neighborhood, there is a downstream consequence with increased inflammatory changes, hormonal changes that ultimately lead to cardiovascular, neurologic, metabolism, immune changes in your body that we think can lead to increased hypertension, increased diabetes, increased stroke, ultimately increased mortality. This may be one of the reasons why people living in lower income neighborhoods have higher mortality rates. So in this study, we used heart rate as a marker for stress. We measured people's heart rates as they actually walked around their neighborhood past vacant lots and then vacant lots that had been greened to understand how people were actually reacting second by second to walking past these aspects of their neighborhood.
And you found remarkably different results when they were walking past greened vacant lots that had been prettied up and made into parks, as opposed to when they were walking by blighted properties. I mean, these were physiological changes in people's bodies.
Exactly. So the greening intervention that we did is actually very simple and low-cost intervention where you take a vacant lot that is filled with trash, overgrown with vegetation. You clean the trash, you plant new grass, you plant one or two trees, and a very simple wooden post and rail fence around the perimeter of the lot. So it takes it from a blighted space to a clean and green space. And when we had people walk past the vacant lots both before and after the greening, we also had a control group that walked past vacant lots that had no intervention, we found that overall heart rate was reduced significantly up to 15 beats a minute in the people who were walking past the green lots. I will mention that this greening, I did not make up this greening intervention myself. It's something that was pioneered by the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society here in Philadelphia. And they've been doing this intervention for many years. And we're just starting to study it and really see some of the positive health impacts.
All right. So why in some neighborhoods, it might not be economical to remove an entire home. There are some smaller greening changes that can be made, like the ones that you've just described. And the impact on the health is really significant, isn't it?
Yeah, and we're still at the beginning of studying what the long-term health impacts are, but we have good data to show that there are physiologic changes that people experience in a positive direction when they walk past a green lot versus a non-green lot. We also, there have been studies with the green vacant lots asking people just to report how they feel. And people do report feeling safer after greening. They report less stress. And some people also report more exercise, which you can imagine will also have a positive impact on health in the long term.
There's an ordinance in Philadelphia that requires that doors and windows be put on homes, even if they're vacant. I guess your colleagues have studied that as well.
Yeah, so some of my colleagues have studied that. Rather than having an abandoned home, an abandoned row home, have boarded up doors and windows, they have to put an actual real door and real windows on the home. So it appears from the outside that there is someone living in that home, and it's more safely secure so that people cannot get into the home. What my colleagues found was that homes that underwent this intervention compared to homes that didn't had less crime around them and less total assaults, less gun crime. It's a very relatively cheap intervention that can have big impact on crime data, which, you know, by the way, I do very strongly believe that violent crime and people's safety is very much a health problem that doesn't just lead to, you know, the physical health problems of victims of crime, but can impact the physical and mental health of all of those in the neighborhood who are impacted.
Sure. Well, we certainly have a number of neighborhoods here in Baltimore in which life expectancy is considerably lower than in other more affluent neighborhoods. And this is the kind of study that just, you know, backs that up. But Dr. Gina South, we very much appreciate your time this morning, and thanks for sharing your research.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Gina South has studied, among other things, how blight impacts health and well-being. Dr. South is a resident in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. We've got a link to a couple of Dr. South's articles on this subject at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stay with us. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. I'd like to talk a little bit about voting. In April, voters in Baltimore will be asked to choose Democratic and Republican nominees for mayor. The general election is in November, but if history repeats itself, the Democrat who wins in April will prevail in November. For the first time in a long time, the incumbent isn't running, and as a result, the field is huge. 29 people are running for mayor of Baltimore City. Of those, 13 are Democrats, and 6 or 7 of those Democrats are given a decent or better chance to win. But just who will elect them? In 2011, in the last Democratic mayoral primary, about 75,000 people voted, and more than 217,000 people who could have voted didn't. Not involved, one way or the other. The winner of that primary, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, won it with just under 39,000 votes. She got about the same number of votes in the general election. Her Republican opponent got 6,000 votes. So in the general election, 322,000 people, more than half of the city's residents, could have voted, but didn't. So here's what that means. 87% of eligible voters in our city chose not to be involved in electing the person who has run Baltimore for the past 5 years. So if you accept the common wisdom that the Democrat always wins the general election, given that 9 out of 10 registered city voters are Democrats, then the calculation is only slightly less shameful. 75% of registered Democrats chose not to be part of the decision. That's a lot of people. Hundreds of thousands of voters could have had something to say about who would change the pension system, manage the snowstorms, fire a police commissioner, hire a police commissioner, appoint school board members, address the budget deficits, and coordinate efforts to quell violence that injured hundreds of civilians and police and wreaked havoc on nearly 400 businesses. But in 2011, 9 out of 10 people had nothing to do with choosing the most important person in city government. So back to those 6 or 7 viable Democrats on the ballot this April. If the same number of people don't vote in this primary this time around, any one of those 6 or 7 could statistically win by getting fewer than 13,000 votes. So let's say someone gets 20,000 votes, which is way less than candidate Rawlings Blake got the last time. And let's say the rest of the candidates do what most of the candidates did the last time, which is to say they get fewer than 10,000 votes. That means the person with 20,000 votes wins in a landslide. 20,000 votes. Our next mayor could be elected without earning the support of 94% of the people who live here. You have to vote. It's not just our civic duty, it's our civic opportunity to let whoever wins know how he or she should govern. A vote for someone who loses sends just as powerful a message as a vote for the person who wins. We don't have a runoff system in Baltimore, so it's possible that the person who wins the Democratic primary for mayor will win with more people voting against him or her than voting for him or her. So some would suggest that that's a reason not to vote. Your vote doesn't really count. Nonsense. If you win an election, you need to know how many people voted for you and how many people didn't vote for you. People who just don't vote at all do nothing to inform the winner about what the city's priorities should be. You gotta vote. I mean, what if instead of 75,000 people voting in this primary, 375,000 people voted? Instead of almost nobody voting, what if almost everybody voted? What if the candidates who are running for mayor had to convince hundreds of thousands of us, instead of just 10 or 20,000 of us, that he or she is the best person for the job? And, of course, our votes for mayor aren't the only ones we'll cast on April 26th. Candidates for city council, the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Senate, and president are on the ballot as well. What if we were all part of all of these decisions? What if none of us succumbed to the cynicism that says government doesn't matter? What if we started telling our elected officials that we're paying attention? Come to our website, wypr.org/MarylandMorning. And we'll shoot you a link to information on how to register. If you know someone who isn't registered, please see to it that he or she does register. If somebody tells you she isn't voting, engage her. Talk her into it. We have until April 5th to register to vote in the primary. Early voting starts April 14th. The primary, April 26th. We'll give you the results that night here on WYPR, and I hope that when you hear those results, you'll do so knowing that you are part of them. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard. or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning again, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us. You know, we've been talking a lot this morning about the many ways in which abandoned houses and vacant lots can debilitate neighborhoods and affect people's health. The Baltimore Office of Promotion and the Arts, lovingly known as BOPA, and Baltimore City's Growing Green Initiative are enlisting artists to help alleviate the deleterious effects of blighted areas. They've started a new program called Lots Alive. Maggie Villegas is a public art project specialist at BOPA. Jenny Guillaume is with the Department of Planning's Sustainability Office, and they join me here in Studio A. Good morning. Good to see you guys.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
So, Maggie, there's about 16,000 vacant homes. How many vacant lots are there in Baltimore?
There's about 14,000
vacant
lots. Jenny,
you know that.
Yep.
Because you've counted them, right? We've tried to count them.
I've been to a lot of them, actually.
Yeah, you've been to a lot of them. Good. And so this Lots Alive program then, Maggie, you're sort of administering that for BOPA. How does this work? This is a grant program? You gave some money to neighborhoods and artists? And
yes. It's a temporary public art grant program. So we're looking for proposals from artists, community organizations, designers, architects, anybody who is interested in creating a one-day to one-year activation on a city-owned or privately owned vacant lot in the city of Baltimore.
Activation means creating some sort of work of art.
Yes. Yeah. So sculptures, performances, exhibitions, anything art-related that would activate the space.
Mm-hmm. And Jenny, these are meant to be temporary. In other words, some of these lots, we sort of know long-term what's going to happen with them, but it's not going to happen for
exactly
6 months, a year.
So this is a way that we felt like we could clean and green the lot in a little bit of a different way. So not just planting trees or reseeding or fencing, but bringing art into the vacant lot and just stabilizing in a different way and having a different interaction that residents walking by will see the site-specific sculpture or event and be able to interact with a vacant lot in a different way than just greenery.
Mm-hmm. And as we just heard from Dr. South and at Penn, who studied this thing, when folks walk by lots that have been improved in one way or the other, either by greening and, you know, putting a fence or having some, you know, nicer thing than the trash, heart rates go down, stress levels go down. I mean, so this really does have a palpable physical effect on folks. So I guess you've picked like 6 projects, Maggie, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And how many folks threw their hat in the ring for this?
We had over 20 applications. They were all really wonderful, so it was really tough to even narrow it down to those 6. We are awarding grants throughout the city, which is really exciting, in neighborhoods ranging from Old Goucher to Sandtown to Sowebo. And they run the gamut in terms of the type of art that they're creating. Some of the pieces are sculptural. Some of them are more performance-based as well. There's even a sort of DIY sign-making workshop that local artist Gary Mullen is conducting with 10 community organizations who are adopting lots in their own neighborhoods. And he's basically doing an artist workshop with them to teach them how to make signage for their own communities.
Mm-hmm. And Jenny, having the community buy into this project is really important. There's even some money going to community members for the upkeep of these, I guess, right?
Exactly. So that was really important that we had communities engaged. We really asked artists to work directly with communities. They had to have a letter of support because communities are the ones that live with these vacant lots in their daily lives and wanted to make sure that they were supportive of this project and were really getting benefits out of it as well.
And so the artists themselves went to these communities and said, I want to do this project.
Exactly.
What do you guys think? You know,
and
can we all get
we also
it?
Had communities approach us and say, we're really interested in this project. Could you help link us to an artist? Mm-hmm. So it kind of worked both ways in terms of artists being excited about this, but also community members asking us for ideas and artists to connect them with.
Mm-hmm. That's Jenny Guillaume. She is from the city's sustainability office. Maggie Villegas also joins us from BOPA, the Baltimore Office of Promotion and the Arts, on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, Jenny, you also have a Growing Green Initiative. That's different than this art thing,
correct?
Right? What's that?
So the Growing Green Initiative was officially launched by the mayor in May of 2014, and it's a comprehensive approach to developing greening strategies for vacant lots. As part of that launch, we launched the Green Pattern Book, which outlines 8 different patterns of different greening treatments that could be applied to vacant lots. And part of that Green Pattern Book, one of the patterns is clean and green. So this is how Lots Alive fits into the overall Growing Green initiative. So clean and green really means just stabilizing vacant lots. Mm-hmm. And we thought art could be a good way to pair just a basic greening treatment as a clean and green site and stabilizing it. Mm-hmm. Other projects that we have, when we launched the program, we also started a competition where we asked community members and engineers and designers to create vacant lot designs, and then we had funding for actual implementation. So stormwater management is being implemented, community managed open spaces, we have a flower farm being implemented. So it really ranges what we do. We try to look at a whole host of different greening treatments for different sites.
Mm-hmm. And Maggie, one of the things that strikes me as very cool about this is that some of these projects that you've decided to fund in this first round are really interactive. It's not just people walking by the lots. These are artists who are inviting people to come on the lots and do stuff. There's one of them, it's like an outdoor lending library or something.
Yes. So local artist Stuart Watson, who is sort of a veteran of the Station North arts community, and she is creating an outdoor mini library at the Wonderground. So she's actually creating sort of tiny bookshelves that look like 3-story row houses, tables that look like warehouses. There's also, so it'll be stocked with books. She's programming it with readings. She's creating these sittable stoop benches that people can sit in and sort of just kind of hang out and enjoy the space. And so, yes, and that's actually going to be a portable piece as well. So who knows where it'll end up after it's done at the Wonderground.
I really like that project a lot because after, you know, the year time frame, it could move to another vacant lot in the neighborhood. So that's really what we're looking at, is if we could potentially have kind of traveling art exhibits that could further activate different vacant lots in the neighborhood. So I'm actually really excited
about
that.
Well, that's nice.
Project.
So they're temporary in these spaces, but they could be portable and
exactly.
move to someplace else.
In theory,
yeah. Yeah, nice. All right, Maggie Vijegas, she's a public art project specialist at BOPA, and Jenny Guillaume is with the Sustainability Office of the Baltimore City Department of Planning. Thanks so much for coming in, guys. Really appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having us.
Their new program is called Lots Alive, and you'll soon be able to check out the work of various artists who are making creative interventions in places like Greenmount West, Old Goucher, Druid Heights, Sewebo, and Sandtown Winchester. We've got more on our website, WIPR.org. Marilyn Morning is directed and engineered and co-hosted and duct taped together by Nathan Sterner, Rob Sivak, John McCone, and Kathleen Cahill are our producers. Lauren Ferguson and Brooke Savage are our interns. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville is our Java source. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts is the guy who wrote and recorded our theme music. On Monday, Senator Cory Booker joins me to talk about his new book. We'll also have this month's installment of the Accountability Index with Mark Reuter of the Baltimore Brew. He and I will talk about money and the mayor's race. I'm also going to talk trash with Jeff Raymond of the Baltimore City Department of Public Works. We're not going to make fun of each other. We're actually going to talk about the new way trash is going to be collected in Baltimore. And then maybe we will make fun of each other. Who knows? Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russick reviews a world premiere at the Olney Theater Center. So plenty of reasons to join us Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, thanks so much for hanging with us today. Garrison Keillor is up next with the Writer's Almanac. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.